Right.
The Gemara explains. The Talmud in Tanit 20... Ooh, good idea if I'd have checked it up before I came. I think it is 26a, isn't it? I think it's 26a. I think so. Says, Mishanichnas Av, when the month of Av comes in, Mema'atim besimcha, we decrease our levels of happiness. It goes on to explain we don't build happy buildings, i.e. not buildings that we need to live in with a roof over our head. So things like conservatories or holiday homes. We don't buy new clothes. And it comes to the nine, we don't eat meat, drink wine. These are things mentioned in the Talmud. Now, very important. The expression used was we decrease our levels of sin. And as I made sure not to say the word sad at the beginning, it does not say one is sad. To be sad. No. Judaism never encourages sadness. We are never allowed to be sad. Not even for 0.01 of a second. Sadness, that's out of the question. So much so, that even on Tisha B'Av day, if one is feeling sad and depressed, one is allowed to listen to music to cheer him up. Not that I'm encouraging that if you're just feeling bored. We're talking about really depressed. People are depressed and really sad. They can cheer themselves up even on Tisha B'Av. There is, however, one opinion, the opinion of the Mogen Avraham, a very, very famous halachic commentator. And he quotes from the Tosfos at the side, Ein smeichin klal. What does it mean we decrease our simcha? It means we don't rejoice at all. There are other opinions that say, yeah, we can rejoice, but just not in the ways that it is mentioned. So we don't wash our clothes, we don't bathe for pleasure, we don't eat meat, drink wine, but other than that, we can be happy and we can rejoice. In fact, we can learn Torah. Torah is happy. Tisha B'Av, we don't learn Torah because that brings happiness. So we don't do extra happy things. He says you don't rejoice at all. Ein smeichin klal. We don't rejoice at all in these periods of the 9.5 days. However, still does not say we should be sad. It's like paraf. We are on level naught. We're not sad. And we're not, in fact, it says smeichin. We don't rejoice. Happy, yes. Rejoicing, no. Let me read you something about happiness before I go on to say all the gruesome sad bits. Because you need to be happy first. I want you to explain how to be happy and sad. Well, I'm not going to do that bit, but still. Let me explain to you a Mishnah. In Pirkei Avos, we read it last week, so that's why I noticed this. No, it was 2 weeks ago when we read chapter 6, which is where I noticed this. Where it talks about the 48 ways, no it's not, yeah, 48 ways that one needs, 48 methods of acquiring the Torah. Things like learning, respecting one's elders, limiting one's sleep, or limiting one's schmoozing, all these ways of acquiring the Torah. And one of them is besimcha, with happiness. One has to learn and study and generally be happy, otherwise one can't acquire Torah knowledge. So let me read out how he explains, the Midrash explains this idea of being happy. Besimcha, what does it mean? Sheyilman mitoch simcha, a person must learn constantly through joy. We shouldn't be like a burden, I've got to do this. No, we should be happy. We're enjoying coming to the shir. Either because of the refreshments, or because we want to learn. Either way, we should be happy that we're coming for a shir. Sheyvashar she'adam shoy ba'atzos, because at the time a person becomes sad, ein divito nichnasim b'libo, you can't accept the words of Torah. They won't go into it. As it says, into Hashem Shem Basimcha, you must serve God through happiness, which you will now see on the bottom of my new cards, my new business cards. I put that on. Serve God with joy. I thought I'd put that on my business cards from here. Put it on. It's a posuk we say every morning. It's a posuk from Psalm 100, verse 3 or 4. Serve God with joy. And that is on my business cards. So important, I deemed it as equally as important as my telephone number. Next to it on my card. Serve God with joy. So he asked the question. The Ketzad Nismach. How can we be happy? V'anu melei avon, and we are full of sins. The Christians always go on about we are sinners. Believe me, I've been at their conferences over the last few weeks and I've added up to my ear and muffs in it. They're big believers. We're all sinners. We've all got no hope. Ah, we should all be going around being sad every day. Not the Jewish idea whatsoever.
He's asking this question. So he's basically asking, how can we be happy when we're full of sins? How can we not be depressed when we realize how far gone we are? Now, this also we have to learn later. Because when the Beis HaMikdash stood, which we'll talk about later, then other maybe carbon, you bought a carbon, you were forgiven. Valavim, Shorin, the Levites were singing away. And you saw this beautiful simcha. Everyone was dancing and laughing away. And you were happy afterwards. But nowadays, we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. So, we're going to talk about that later. That's one of the things we're missing. So how can one be happy? For Eitzor and the method that one can use to be happy is as follows. Sheyachshev Adam Belivo, a person must think in his heart at all times. God is reviving me every second. The fact that I'm alive and I'm not dead means God has decided that now I should be alive. That I am needed in the world. The cosmos has decided that I should be, not by cosmos, it is being decided that because of everything, the way the world is run, I need to be in the world. Quite important. I need to be in the world. Every second. Or Masali Nishmasi, and God returns every morning when I wake up, he returns my soul to me. He could easily kill me when I sleep. Just not bother returning my soul. But no, he returns it every morning. So every morning he has decided, you know what? Zev needs to live today. God has decided every single day, I should wake up. Remember, God has decided. God of the world created everything. He has ordained that I should live. Every second I could die, next second I could drop dead. Heart attacks, strokes, driving in the car, anything could happen. The roof could fall in. Anything could happen. So many ways. It could be a bomb. Somebody could come and shoot me, stab me. There's so many ways, that's not the gruesome bit yet. So many ways a person can die at any second. But he's not. He's alive. That's because God wants him to be alive. He has decided you should live now. How amazing is that? And then it goes on to say, because the Shekhinah, God's presence, and remember this week because we're going to talk about this later, does not dwell Mitochatz was among sadness. Mitoch schok through levity. Lo mitoch kalos vos, lo mitoch simcha, lo mitoch simcha shel dva mitzvah. When a person is doing mitzvah, is happy, being Jewish, being alive, then God's presence can rest upon him. So we can see how important it is to be happy at all times. Every single second of the day. And this happiness applies every single second of every single day of the year. Including in the 9 days, and included on Tisha B'Av. Let's never be sad. We must never be sad. We must always be happy and grateful that we are alive. In fact, seeing so much destruction will make us feel, oh, there's been so much destruction, so many terrible things, but I'm still alive. God has chosen to spare me. You hear people say, if they're 4 yards away from somebody who got shot in a massacre, or they were. Should have gone to a station where somebody was blown up in a bomb. And, oh, thank God, God has saved me. They get really happy because, oh, I should have been there. But God chose to do something that I wasn't there. Or he shot the fellow next to me and not me. We should feel that every second. I'm alive. He has chosen to make me live. I can breathe in the air. Every single second of the day. And that happiness we need to have every time. Including on Tisha B'Av itself. And to prove this, that even though we have mourning, which we'll talk about, one must still have sadness. Remember what we just read. Ein Hashchina Shoreh, the Shekhinah does not rest, only on, no, not amongst sadness, only amongst happiness. And Elisha the prophet, he couldn't get prophecy because he got angry with the king. I'm not going to tell the story. In Malachim Beis chapter Gimel, if one wants to read it, Kings 2 chapter 3, he got annoyed and God left him. And he said, "Kuchuni menagein, bring me back the harp player. Play me some beautiful music." Played him beautiful music. He was in a good mood again, and God gave him the prophecy, and he prophesied to the king. So that raises a very, very, very interesting question. In Megillas Eicha, the book of Eicha, which we read on Tisha B'Av, Eicha was told by God to Yirmiyahu, who said it to the king Yoshiyahu, years before the temple was destroyed, 3-4 years before, 9 years he started, to warn him this is what's going to happen. Didn't listen, of course. Thought he knew best. Thought he could take on God. Not quite sure how he thought about that, but anyway. So, he told him this. This was transmitted by God. It's one of the books, 24 books of Tanakh, which were all given through prophecy, Ruach HaKodesh. And it's a very sad book. So much so, you have many times the word crying in it. For instance, Bocho Sivke Balalo, I'm crying at night. Eini, Eini, Yodjamai, my eyes are pouring with water. Now, he's not going to lie. He's not going to make up lies. So his eyes were pouring with water. He was crying and wailing. And all the things about him crying and being terribly distressed are all true. He's not going to say, I'm wailing, which is a problem in Yom Kippur when we talk about crying and we're not crying. It's a big problem because we're lying to God. Which is why I want to make sure one does cry. But anyway. So he was crying his eyes out. But yet, he still got the nevuah from God. He was standing in front of the king. So therefore, he must have been in a state of happiness. Because if he wasn't in a state of happiness, he would not have received the prophecy. So even though he was crying and wailing about what he was being told about the bloodshed and the butchery, and he was being told that the mothers will end up eating their children alive because they've got no food. Can you imagine how distressing that was? But yet he still had to maintain the simcha, the happiness. Otherwise the connection, the inspiration from God to carry on telling the king what was going on would have been lost. Because as we've seen, when one is sad, remember the words, when one is sad and upset and depressed, one cannot get nevuah, prophecy, spiritual help, and therefore it would have stopped. So to prove that one can have this balance, don't ask me how. I haven't got that far yet. Because I haven't got to the real mourning. So that one has to have this balance of always being happy, but yet also having this balance that one can cry one's eyes out about all the tragedies that have happened, but yet still be happy. Doesn't mean going around beaming one's face off, rejoicing and jumping and laughing away. That's why we say we don't eat meat, we don't drink wine, we don't wear fresh clothes, we don't bathe for pleasurable purposes. We don't go around jumping for joy. We do signs of mourning, we don't wear leather shoes, we sit on the floor. Some people rip their garments. Some people put ash in their hair. We don't wear makeup, aftershave, or wear jewellery. All these things are signs of mourning. But happiness, we must always have. Every single second of the day. And we must be grateful that we are Jewish, we said many times. How many times does the words of a somachta, you should rejoice, come in the Torah? I distinctly remember we counted last year in the sermon 7 times in Parshas Re'eh alone, which is coming up in a few weeks, you should rejoice. Every second, every day, one must be happy one is alive, happy one is a Jew, able to perform such mitzvahs in front of God. But one must be able to mourn at the same time. How to get this balance? I have absolutely no idea. You'll have to get somebody else to talk to you about that. Because I've never got to the real mourning side. So I can't tell you how it feels. Not really got to the happiness of being Jewish either. But anyway. The balance, I'm trying to bring out the point. Even if I can't explain how, the point is still there. Each in their own way. We have the mourning side. Now, big question is. People say, well, yes.
Examples in the Holocaust were in order to preserve life, there were mothers who had to place their hands over their babies' mouths to stop them from crying out if they were betrayed or discovered. by Nazis. Or something else, but to actually kill your own child because you were starving.
These are historical facts. I'm not justifying them. No, I wouldn't even dream of questioning it, what it must have been like at that time. But those are historical facts brought down in books of the Romans at the same time. So it's not whether you believe or not. These are historical facts.
But it's hard to comprehend and to accept that that's what happened.
But that should just impress upon you just how terrible the situation must have been. If a mother could do such a thing, the situation must have been so bad, so hopeless.
But in the light of what you were saying, how would you define happiness? Because many of the things you have mentioned, I mean, how could you be, I don't know what your definition is, happy? If somebody close to you dies, are you saying, yes, you've got to sit shiver for them, you've got to be heartbroken, you've got to be happy. Well, could you define happiness?
No, I can't. I don't know how this balance works, and practically I can't tell you how it works.
Well,
I'm just thinking the facts.
What is happiness?
I think you should ask David Cameron, because he's telling everyone to be happy.
Well, I don't know what it means.
Well, ask him.
But that's why I'm asking.
No,
I can't associate the two.
But isn't it happiness? The opposite of sadness. No, not at all. The happiness is within you, so you can't find. It's different for you.
It's content.
It's for me than it is for the rabbi.
It's just in the content.
Well, I mean, I know you have lost your parents, but how would you feel when you were sitting shiver? Could you in any way feel what we would define as happy?
No.
And that's
not
what
really.
I'm trying to put
not really, but then, as Cyril always said, as we say at Yiska, sometimes the passing of someone is actually a happy event for them because they're passing, they're not suffering. Sometimes it's their wish. So it's different. It's different in every different circumstance.
Yeah, but we define. I mean, I don't want to. But we define happiness as a particular feeling.
We do. I remember when I was at school, just got an awful long way. I had master used to talk about in comparative religion. He used to say, "Can you describe heaven and can you describe hell?" Well, everybody could describe hell, but heaven is different to everybody. Heaven is a different concept for everybody. What your heaven might be might not be mine. And I use it in the loosest possible sense, not in a religious sense at all. But that's the same sort of comparison. When something's wrong, you really know it's wrong. Mm. But the other side of the coin is when you're happy, when you think of what your ideal place in this world would be, it's different for you, different for me, different for everyone. My view, anyway.
But the real issue, surely, is what you said. I mean, there's a danger, perhaps, because you are trying to take these things to such a detailed level, that, in fact, when you talk about the balance, that's something we're doing all the time. I mean, we do it without necessarily being aware of it. I mean, you can lose someone, but you have to raise the spirit, say, of a family, because you know that they need to you to do that. So it's... The balance is what you're after. It's perhaps if one is looking for some. You also said this too, but just remind people that it's not an extreme form of happiness. You're not going around laughing and behaving like a comic.
State.
And you're not at the same time in such despair that you don't lift anybody's spirits up at all. Mm. So it's this balance.
And I said, getting the balance right, how to do it, that I've no idea.
We've got to remember that happiness is a personal gift, in a sense.
Yeah.
Where we don't always realise we're happy till afterwards. And so to say that you're happy under certain circumstances doesn't really in itself mean anything. It's only in looking back you can say, right, I was happy in such a time.
I also think that the happiness being described here and being described by a lot of the rabbis is the very simplest form of happiness. The basic happiness of being alive. Or being Jewish, they give a very good parable. If a person is stranded on a shipwreck, for instance, and he's drowning away, And all of a sudden he sees the helicopter. Sees the helicopter from rescue, and he brings down sees the helicopter there. And he's still in the water. He's still freezing and he's still drowning. But he gets happy as soon as he sees the helicopter. Why does he get happy? Even though he's still drowning now, but he knows, here it is, in 2-3 minutes, I'm alive, because of all the times in the water, there's no hope. He thinks he's dying, he's lost all hope. All of a sudden, he's, I'm alive. That basic feeling of happiness, I'm alive. That's the simplest form of happiness.
Rabbi Tatz of London says that happiness comes from doing things that we should be doing.
Happiness.
Happiness comes from doing things that we should be doing.
In Torah and Mitzvahs.
Yes, happiness comes from doing things that we should be doing.
I think that's the idea of contentment. That
so rather than what meaning. We like to.
Contentment. Yeah.
The things that we should be doing that makes us happy. Yeah. So even a person sitting shiver, therefore, he's doing what he should be doing, therefore he's happy.
Yes.
I mean, definitely mourning is encouraged. We see that one is encouraged to cry about one's relatives that have deceased. So there is no contradiction there. How the balance works, I don't know.
It's a subconscious state of mind where you've no control over it. It's an ambient feeling that you have, but you don't know why or how. You can't describe.
Mm-hmm. Well, most people don't go into depression when they lose relatives. So they keep the balance somewhere. Yes, they're sad, but they don't flip over into total depression. So there is somehow a line that you can see you can cross or you can't cross. So there is some sort of a...
It's actually a terrible feeling, which stays with you for months afterwards. They say about 6 months that you begin to come out of it. But it's so overwhelming when it happens, because never get into this. But you always think it won't happen to you or anybody you are close to. I'm not getting any further, because I can't quite follow what you're saying.
I have a point, and I don't know whether it's relevant at all, but once again, the Holocaust, which is like the extreme, one of the extreme examples of the limits of human suffering in history, or recent history, shall we say. Viktor Frankl, who wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning, Adam HaChapez Mashmaut, where he talked about... when he was in the concentration camps, he had been a psychiatrist, I think, or a psychologist, I can't remember, but he devised something called logotherapy. But basically, he encouraged people, even when they were in the darkest pits of despair, as often, of course it was all the time, every minute, not just Tisha B'Av, he encouraged them to seek meaning in their existence. So that they would never lose the sight of their own humaneness, and they would not suffer the ultimate humiliation that the persecutors wanted to visit upon. That no matter what was happening on the outside, no matter how filthy and how deprived they were, and how persecuted, that they would always see some value in their own existence. It's probably one of the hardest things to have done. But I, the way that I see Tisha B'Av, the feeling, not so much of happiness, personally, it's more perhaps a day of reflection, of being thankful or grateful for being alive. So it's that kind of happiness of, you know, that I am here now, despite.
Well, as with everything, as we'll see later on, that despite all despair, there was always rebuilding. And happiness. In fact, well, I'll come to that later, so we'll be with that.
Can I just ask a slightly offbeat question on this? Do you draw a line between happiness and pleasure?
Between or in?
That's like a show in itself.
Unfortunately, yes, but...
Yes, it would.
Yeah.
The simple answer would be yes.
I'm thinking of the comment you made about if you're doing something you should be doing. You often derive pleasure, but not necessarily happiness.
I think if you're pleasantly, let's say, dabbling or learning, you do get happy from it. If you're doing it like helping a lady across the road, you get happy from having a lady across the road.
People were saying when we had our demonstration of the Tahara house that doing a Tahara, as difficult as it may be, makes people feel very, very rewarding, very fulfilled, that they've done something meaningful, despite all the sadness.
How far would you try to relate some of this to anybody who might have suffered in the recent events in Norway. It seems to me that we ought to, it would be rather foolish not to take an example. There weren't Jewish people as far as I know, but either there were or not. I mean, if a non-Jew was saying to you, and had listened to the discussion up to this moment, what could you say to him? What could we offer?
You mean the people who've been through it?
Yes. What could we offer? I mean, you know, to me, Judaism isn't an isolated thing. We've got to be able to show. We've got to be able to relate. Well, you've said enough in the time we've had, and others have commented. How far can we transmit some of these things to somebody who...
In the sense of why he did it and how it can be allowed to happen?
Right. And the whole process of what it means to the families and the selection, totally arbitrary. I just wonder what one could say. Do we offer nothing?
Well, we do offer things. Well, it's a difficult question to answer just like this. When we're sort of sitting here, it's something that requires a lot of thought.
Do you ever feel, I mean, as a rabbi, that we are...
I mean, there are difficult questions. People ask you, why did God allow the Holocaust to take place? Yeah. Why did this happen? These are difficult questions.
I was thinking about relating it to non-Jewish people. I mean, do we ever attempt to do that? Do we ever say there is something in our religion? Because as you said at the beginning, you know, other religions perhaps offer too much, like a salesman perhaps. But what do we ever give anything among Jews?
Well, the same ideas you can say about the terrible tragedies that have happened to Jewish people. There have been a lot of those. Right. You know, it's just what the ideas are, why God allows these things to happen, who knows? All I know is, I say this to some people, I quote it last week or 2 weeks ago, there is a pasuk in Eov, Job, chapter 37, verse number 3, where Job, he was going through all these terrible things he went through, and he was complaining at God, all these things, and God turned around eventually and said to him, chapter 37, verse 3 or 4, it's a wonderful thing to look at, to take it out and to go through it, and God all of a sudden comes and speaks and says, were you there when I laid the foundation stones of the earth? No. Were you there when I hung the sun and the moon and the stars and the sky? Were you there when I set the formulas for the constellation of the stars? Wonderful chapter we go through. Were you there when the angels first sang their song? It's a wonderful chapter. And of course, if all the rhetorical questions, the answer is no. And the end goal goes, well, I was. And at the end of the day, one does not know why, how, whatever. But one has to, the idea of faith. Somehow there is a plan. What you make of it, who knows?
But isn't that the answer? There's a master plan that none of us understand, and if you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time when he decrees that that's going to happen, then you can't explain. You're in that place. Same point as the rabbi made. I remember my father telling us several times about during the war when he was in London, missing his normal train, and the train was bombed. And a lot of us have had experiences like that. Had we gone to that place at that time, we might not be here to tell the tale. I think it's just I'd be very interested to know the Jewish view of predestination and how much is written, how far in advance. I mean, we know a year in advance because of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but it's how much is preordained, and I agree with Eric. You can't explain these things. Somebody goes mad. What happened in London on the 7th of July? There were Jewish people there. There were Jewish people that were killed in that bombing. It happened to be in quite a Jewish area. The tragedy on the underground. I just think if you have faith that somebody's actually written the story.
Is it faith or fate?
Well, we don't really believe in fate, in fate being sort of accidental or being sort of unregulated. One of the reasons, just to digress, why this month is called Av. Av means father. And the reason why it was called Av is to remind everybody it's one of the saddest months, Tisha B'Av.
Things remember of Father.
That it's not random in any way.
There is Father, God, up there. That's why it's called of Father. To remember, yes, our Father up in heaven. We have something there to pray to, something to acknowledge. And we don't know why, what, how, where, but we have to acknowledge that there is a God who has his ideas and plans.
I just want to say, going to what Eric said, the Almighty said to Abraham, through you all the nations of the earth will be blessed, or the families of will be blessed. So therefore there was some concern, or is concern, for the whole world.
Oh, we do have concern with our world.
Yes.
Just because people weren't Jewish, or things like in Japan, where perhaps there are not that many Jews, doesn't mean that we don't consider it because of God, or anything like that. But that's one of the things the temple, which I'll come on to speak about, we offered 70 sacrifices on Sukkot for the 70 nations. And one of the gods, if they would have known what we'd do for them, they wouldn't have destroyed our temple. But anyway, so if I'd like to move on to the next bit, which is the question, well, it's very easy to say on Tisha B'Av one mourns for the Beis HaMikdash and one should mourn, and we do these signs of mourning. But it's very difficult to mourn unless one knows what one is mourning. What are we missing? What are we mourning for? What is all this mourning all about? So this is where it gets gruesome. So the easy way, the very easy way for us nowadays to get some sort of understanding. I'm going to do this in two parts. First, the easy way, and then the way it gets gruesome. The easy way to get to this idea of mourning and to feel this idea of mourning and to shed tears is for the things we mentioned earlier. The things that happened around the destruction of the temple. So I'm not talking about the destruction of the temple itself, but we're going to come on to that shortly, because Tisha B'Av is about the destruction of the temple. We cannot lose sight of that, and we're going to discuss that soon. But the easy way to bring oneself to this idea of level of mourning, and to tears perhaps, is to use practically some of the gruesome stories that surround the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the millions of people that were killed, the terrible tragedies that befell people, the starvation one has to own look in Somalia. You see the images of the children, one can see the bones sticking out, and one can imagine that that must have been what it was like in Yerushalayim when people were so starved for 3 years from the time they sieged on Asar B'Teves, the 10th of Tevet, where we have the fast. 3 years they sieged, they had a bit of food to last them for a bit, and then obviously the food ran out. People snuck in and out every so often, got a bit of food, but on the whole, certainly the end period, there was nothing. Total famine, and therefore you can imagine what they might have looked like. Can bring ourselves to the appreciation, as it describes, of people who ate people's dead bodies for food. That's all they can have, the desperation, and to appreciate that. That is an easy way of bringing somebody to this idea of mourning. I would like to read this out, because I guess it might be a bit gruesome, but I think people need to hear it to help them to mourn on Tisha B'Av, not just a day like any other day. Not just a day where we can just say, well, we'll go to work, we don't need to bother about it. Just because we're not fasting, it doesn't mean anything to us. Whatever our religious levels are, it is a day that we shall stop and think. Obviously, we use other tragedies like the Holocaust are all mourned for on this day. We use this one day, fasting day a year. And I think it's important to sort of read out, and I apologise, as I said, for the gruesome nature of the things I'm about to read out. And these things were all brought down either in the Talmud or brought down in other various different books that were written at the time. Once the city was in the hands of the Babylonians ran wild. This is now the destruction of the first temple, which was done in the Babylonians, because that was what was documented through these other people. There's other things also at the time of the second temple with the Romans, but this is focusing mainly on the Babylonians in the first temple. They slaughtered every Jew in their path without pity. They butchered fathers and sons together, mothers and their nursing babies. The streets of the city ran red with rivers of blood, the corpses piled up in huge heaps. The enemies committed unspeakable atrocities. They swung around little infants and smashed their heads against the rock. The sage Ullah in the Talmud, Gittin 58a, says there was 9 large measures of babies' brains were found on just one boulder alone. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi reported that 300 children were found hanging together, suspended from one tree branch. An old citizen of Jerusalem once told me,
in this book, that in one valley alone, Nebuzaradan butchered, slaughtered 2,100,000 people. In one valley. And in Jerusalem, on one boulder stone, he butchered 940,000 people. And this whole book is full of stories like this. And I just thought it's important to read it out, even though it is of a gruesome nature, just to impress upon people what actually went on at the time. What it, to imagine, you say what to do, Tisha B'Av afternoon, to sit and think, to imagine, to close one's eyes, and to imagine being there, and what it was like, and the sounds, and the noises, and the sights that would have greeted you during that period. That is the easy way to bring oneself to tears and to mourning, because that's something people can relate to. One can see images nowadays around the world, and I think that was important to read that out. However, just to focus on that would to be missing the point of what the Beis Hamikdash stood for, and what we are lacking now that we don't have it, what we are missing. Why are our lives different because we don't have the Beis Hamikdash? Why are we so busy yearning for the rebuilding of the Beis Hamikdash? And why are we supposed to mourn, not just for the bloodshed that took place, but we are supposed to mourn for the temple? What is this temple? What is it? What is it? Excuse me, if people want to leave, they can leave, but before we get, I'd just like to explain a story which I heard from Rabbi Angel, Rabbi Shlomo Angel, and follow with me, one can shut one's eyes if one feels it will add to the drama of the story. There was an old Jew in Jerusalem, an old man, not religious, in the time of the temple. And he'd never been to Jerusalem. He lived in Israel, rather. Never been to the temple. He'd never been to the three-foot festival. He couldn't be bothered. And you know what? He decided before he died that I think I should go at least once. Go see the temple, see Yerushalayim. So he makes a long, arduous journey. Doesn't know where Yerushalayim is. Couldn't get any internet connection on his phone or his sat-nav. So, and apparently, this is true, apparently, from places like Nineveh, they had to go up to Akko and round the back down the Yaudain, down the River Jordan to Jerusalem that way. Because that was where the roads and the paths were. I mean, you suppose you could have gone over the mountains if you wanted to, but that's apparently how they went. They went up the by the Tel Aviv way, up there to Akko, across, and down the Jordan, sort of on that route that you go, the Kvish something or other. Derech, what is it called? That's right, Derech Yericho. That's the original way they used to come, and we used to go right round Yerushalayim and up the back way, apparently. So he's asking, where? Oh, you've never been to Yerushalayim? What are you talking about? You've never been to Yerushalayim, the temple? You're such an old man, how can it be? He gets embarrassed. Go that way there, then. Gets to Akko, and he says, right, where am I supposed to be turning to turn right? What, you've never been to Yerushalayim? Oh, how could it be? You've never seen the temple? What's this? Go that way. So he's now feeling really embarrassed. Oh, what's this temple? I can't wait to see it. It won't go. So he gets to this temple, he really comes and goes, where am I going now? And people say, well, you've never been to Yerushalayim? What, the temple? You never seen? No, sorry. I don't know. That way, down there. So he makes his way, comes to the bottom place, the lowest place on earth down there that I've seen the signs. Yeah, down there where you see the signs as you go down, maybe they were there in those days, I don't know. Which way to Shalom? Where do I go? What? You're 70 years old, you're feeling really stupid and alert this time, but he's got such a sense of anticipation. What's it going to be like? Okay. So he comes there and he sees the walls far distance. And the butterflies are going in his stomach. What's it all about? Everyone's going on making me feel such an idiot, such a fool, that I've never been to Yerushalayim. Can't wait. Almost there. Comes up to the gates of Yerushalayim. He walks in. Smells the smell of meat. Everywhere he goes, meat, meat, meat. People cooking, people eating, animals, carbonos. Okay, fine. So they're eating very nice. Everyone has to eat. Okay, fine. Maybe the temple. Ah, temple. Ah, there. Comes up to the temple, about to walk in, goes, ah, wait, no, sorry, can't go in. What do you mean, can't go into the temple? No, you have to be purified for 7 days. Go to the mikveh. You have to have the blood of the red heifer sprinkled on you on the third day and the seventh day. You have to wait. Right, okay. Builds the anticipation, right, okay. I'll wait for 7 days, get sprinkled. Is it right? Now you can go. So can you imagine by this time, you know, Santa being knackered, he's forgotten all about that. The adrenaline is pumping. Going up the mountain. Ah, he's excited. Smell. Smells. Meat. Animals. Smell of the incense. Okay. Maybe it's just the odour wafting away. Okay. Goes into the... He sees this beautiful wall, beautiful gates. Ah, this is amazing. The gold and the silver and the... All the beautiful buildings that you can read about, what it was made of. Ah, amazing. Comes to the Shari Nicanor, the Nicanor doors, the huge doors, just before the Azor of the courtyard. And he's so excited, he's closing his eyes, and he opens the gate. And all of a sudden, this river of blood pours over his feet, of blood and bones flying everywhere. And he looks round and he sees these Kohanim in shorts, because they wore shorts up to their knees, running around like idiots, right there and everywhere. Blood, meat, and bones, and animals. And you've got the Kohanim sitting here eating and fretting, and you've got people cooking and blood everywhere. And there's blood on the corners of all the Mizbeach, there's blood everywhere, sprinkled. He's like, what? What have I come for? What's all this blood, all this eating? And what's it all about? What have I come for? Going and running about here, there and everywhere. And he goes home and he thinks, what was the temple? It was some big slaughterhouse. Full of four bathhouses they had there. What was it? Why did I waste my time and get embarrassed at my age? To go to this slaughterhouse, blood everywhere, people running around in white shorts. What for? That's such a beautiful building to ruin it with blood. Everyone's sitting there fretting. Come to Yerushalayim, they're eating their korbanos there. You come to the Azara, they're eating. Everyone's eating. Tire on them. Smells like whatever. Well, what's it all about? Now that's what you could think. But he's missed the point. The Beis HaMikdash. When we think about it in that way, you might think, oh, what's all this called? Bono's blood. It's a totally different idea, again, to, if you like, the idea of a Christian temple, where it's all about prayer, and all that sort of idea. Totally different idea. The temple was where God's Shekhinah, presence. Now don't ask me what the Shekhinah is, because I'm not going to explain it to you, because I don't know, and it will require another Shia to explain what it means, the God Shekhinah, what's that all about? So please don't ask me any questions on it. That's where his Shekhinah rested. The verse goes, Osuli Mikdosh, I make for me a dwelling, V'shochanti b'socham, I will dwell amongst themselves. What does it mean, dwell amongst themselves? God is here, God is there, God is truly everywhere, up, down, left, right. How did the song go?
Here, down, everywhere.
Yeah, but there's the rest of it. Go up, down, left, right, turn around. Oh, whatever the song went, you all probably learned it at school. God is everywhere! So what's this idea of his presence? Is here in the temple. Why do we have to have a temple? God is everywhere, what's this idea? And here's a Beis HaMikdash, if you like. Oh, there was a brilliant word used here, and I've forgotten it. Some flashy English word that I wanted to sound like the chief rabbi. It's some sort of a portal where if you like, all the tefillos that we pray, they all sort of fly around the world, and this is sort of the way they get elevated, the gates of heaven, if you think about it. If you look back in history, what the history of this mountain was, where Adam, he made his first, when he got kicked out of Gan Eden, and he offered a sacrifice, that was on this mountain. Avraham, when he sacrificed Yitzchak, was told to go to this mountain, that's where it was, the altar. But let's look at Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, where he went and he forgot and God made him run back and he fell asleep. What did he say? Ein zeh, this isn't anything but Beis Elokim, the house of God, v'zeh shar ha-shamayim, these are the gates of heaven. There's a brilliant word, if only I could remember it, that this is the gates of heaven are above the temple area. And all our prayers, if you like, that's where, if you like, the magnet for our prayers are. So all our prayers that we ever utter gets magnetized to this area, and that's where they ascend to heaven. Through the Beis HaMikdash, that's where God, we believe, started creating the world. Well, he has to start somewhere, I suppose. He started here, the cornerstone, and he went out like this. This was the middle, this is where he came down. This was his... Again, don't ask me what it all means, because it's very difficult to understand. But that's the basic idea. This is where all our prayers are sent to heaven. This is, oh, it's a brilliant word. Oh, I'm going to show off and say, but anyway, come from here, so it wouldn't be much of a showing off. Oh, I'll remember it when I've left, and I'll probably say it to my sermon, Chalice, just to make sure you don't miss out on what sort of word this was. You all have to come to see if I say his word or not. Oh, a brilliant word for things being pulled up in one space. Anyway.
Transcends.
Transcends is a simple word. It was a really big word. That's a look up in a dictionary. Anyway. So you get the idea. Pardon?
Did you say magnetize?
I said that word, yes.
Oh, that's not a big word.
No. So that's the idea of what the base amygdala is representing. We offered our korbanos. We offered our sacrifices instead of us. That's the idea of a sacrifice. We've said that from the sermon many times. When you came, you're offering it as if it's you. The blood is the life source of a person. That's why the blood's everywhere. It's our life source. Anyway, that is where everything happened. God rested. Whatever that means, I'm not explaining what it means because I don't know. God's presence rested amongst the Jews, and therefore it was so easy. It was so simple to be Jewish in those days. All prayers were answered very easily. All things you want to become rich, okay. So you went to the rich maid, oh, you became rich. You are, everything was so easy. They had the prophets, they had the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. You want to know who to marry? Be good for me, wouldn't it? Good. Everything was so easy. So simple. God's presence was there. They didn't have shuls in those days. There were no shuls. You didn't go to Daven shul every morning. That was only when they destructed the temple to realize, whoops, we've got no focal point. We better make little shuls everywhere for people to come and pray. Otherwise, Jews will never see one another. So they made shuls. But in the olden days, there were no shuls. There was no prayers. It was the face of Mikdash. We didn't need prayers. Yom Kippur. We didn't stay in shul for 10 hours. We had the Yom Kippur service, they have opened the Beit HaMikdash, and we saw whether the little purple wall turned to white. That's what it was all about. It was so easy. God's presence was here. He came down, as it were, to this world, whatever that means, extra, because he's here, he's there, he's everywhere, whatever that means. And that's where bracha, blessing, descends from. If you think about it, blessings come through here, and then it gets dispersed throughout the whole world. Through Yerushalayim, everything is blessed. That's, can you imagine what it would be like? And now we don't have it. Now, to use a good example, Southport Shul is a good example to use. When the Beit HaMikdash was there, the doors were constantly open. The gates of heaven, go in. There's no security on the door. Everything just went in. Now, it's like Southport Shul front door. You can't even open it from the outside. You have to go all the way around. A little sneak in the back. And then there are locks at the bottom. Locks in the middle, locks three quarters of the way up, and then you forgot the locks a third of the way up. So many locks to open the door. That's what the gates of heaven are like now. You can't even open them from outside. Somehow when Yom Kippur, you have to sneak a little leak through, find a little gap in heaven somewhere, and then go and open them from the inside that's so bolted shut. So difficult nowadays for prayers to be answered. Can you imagine what it felt like? The kedusha, the spirituality, the radiance of godliness coming out. Can you imagine what it felt like? What it must have been like to be Jewish? You didn't need synagogues. You didn't need to come to shul. Not that that bit's great, but still. You still, people have places where they came to learn and study the Torah. Can you imagine how you must have felt if your heart was open when you came in? This man was a non-religious man, and he couldn't appreciate it all. But can you imagine, you go and you see all the Kohanim doing, as he said, God's work, doing what was right in the service of God. Can you imagine how it must have felt to stand there watching? They say the Kohen Gadol's face shone like the glow of the firmament, whatever that means, and like a rainbow, his face was shining forth. The radiance of Kedusha, of godliness. Moshe Rabbeinu had to put a mask. Had to put a mask on his face. Somebody explained to me that's why the Christians have something to do with a mask. And I've forgotten it. But anyway, because Moshe Rabbeinu had to put a mask on because his face was shining so much. People couldn't cope. They couldn't cope with his radiance. So they had to put a mask on. Pour him all year round. Can you imagine what it must have been like to feel an experience? And nowadays we don't have that. So difficult to get our prayers answered. As we say, the doors are bolted shut. Locks everywhere, security guards, and then front gates on the car park. There's no even signposts anymore where the shawl is. We can't even know where it is. So difficult. We are so far. But that's not what we are really mourning. That's one part of it. But think of it from God's point of view. And that's how we have to focus. That is what God really wants us to focus on from his point of view. And I always say it's not fair. But if he wants to get rid of it, get rid of it. Bring Moshiach and then we'll all be fine. But it doesn't work like that. So I always say, well, you're expecting us to mourn on your behalf. Or you change it. You do it. You've got the power to do it. But we're not ready, so we can't. That's another schmooze in itself. That's just my little two-bit for the day. But anyway. Yes, well, let me just finish this idea and then then I'll take questions. Otherwise, I'll lose track if you don't mind. And I'll forget where I am, if you don't mind. So God, we have to, he's been banished to the cold. He's out there, locked away in some cupboard, sitting, as I say, on the buffet in front of his throne, instead of actually the throne itself. He is in exile. And we have to think of it from his point of view, because of our sins, because of we weren't ready as people. If you like, we have banished God's presence, whatever that means, and I don't know what it means. His idea of his presence, his Shekhinah, whatever that means. Many might know with all the Kabbalistic ideas what exactly the Shekhinah means, as opposed to God himself, has been banished. We can't feel the feelings, the closeness, the easiness of our prayers to be answered. And I say this film you've probably all seen, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, where God has gone and the wicked witch, the Sultan, is there and everything's snow, covered in snow. You've seen the film? You've read the book? Okay, you know what I'm talking about this time. Good. I see a lot of people nodding at me. So when the wicked witch is there, what we have nowadays, everything's so cold. Stone. Ugh, there's no chance for growth. It's all horrible. Horrible. The sun, everything's on. But when Aslan, the lion, and God is like a lion, which is why the star sign of Av is a lion. Because God is like a lion roaring. Anyway, we're not going into that now. Another Kabbalistic idea, which I have no idea about. But anyway, the idea of God being a lion, Karihis, that's why he roars like a lion. God is compared to a lion. That's why my name is also Arye, like a lion. Anyway, not that I'm saying I'm godlike. Well, anyway, somebody did say, sent me a call saying, I am like God. Because every time people see me, they say, God, not him again. That's what birthday call somebody gave me yesterday. But anyway, I like the bit that I'm compared to God before we read the inner bit. But anyway, just thought I'd lighten the mood. So, God is like a lion, like Aslan. What was it called again? Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. When he comes back, be sunshine, melting all the snow. Everything will be hunky-dory again. Everyone will be smiling. All people who are turned to stone. And the idea of being stone-hearted, will be so nice and friendly again. Just like when Aslan came. That's the idea of a way of understanding what it's like nowadays where God's Shekhinah has been banished. And that's what we really try and have to appreciate. Yes, the bloodshed and the gruesomeness, which I mentioned earlier, should be thought about. And we can use that as a way of bringing ourselves to tears and to feeling of mourning. But what we are really mourning for is the fact we don't have this get out of jail free card of the temple. We don't have our little pass key. We don't have today, I was at the cricket and saw these people in the presidential's tent. I thought, oh, I'd like to be in there. I thought, that one must have been there with the base of me. Those we were in the presidential's tent and everyone else was outside. And the yearning we must have to it's difficult because we don't know what we're missing. We don't know what the temple stood for. Difficult, of course it is. You can't mourn for something you don't know, you can't appreciate. But one can just try and appreciate what it could have been like with the temple. How easy it was with the prophets. Everything was so easy and simple. Why they sinned? Because they got complacent. But that's another story. You see it many times written. They got complacent. They grew old. They grew fat is the analogy. Complacency breeds contempt. And that's why all the sins happened. We've got the temple. Everything will be fine. Oh, don't need to worry. Everything's fine. And of course, it wasn't. So that's what Tisha B'Av is really about. Mourning for the Beis HaMikdash. The temple itself. And just to finish off with a note of happiness. Because all the three have Torahs that we read in the 3 weeks of sadness about the destruction, all finish on a positive note about the rebuilding of the temple. So I'll finish off on a positive note, not to leave you all sad and depressed, hopefully not, because we said it's got to get the balance between being happy and mourning, so let's hope you've got that balance right. very interesting that Chamisha Asar Ba'av is known as one of the happiest days of Jewish calendar. You all know the days the girls and the boys used to go out. I wish they'd revived that nowadays. Might help me, but that's besides the point. The girls and the boys used to go out, happy day. It's known that on Yom Kippur are the two happiest days in the Jewish calendar. Very odd. Very strange. You've just had Tisha B'av, saddest day in Jewish calendar. You've just said, Av is a... When Av comes in, you decrease the levels of Simcha. So why go and make this day, this happiest day of the Jewish calendar? Make it in Tamils, make it in... Why are you putting this happiest day? You've gone from the darkest day of our time, the most mournful day. You've gone to the most happiest day. A week later, we're now rejoicing on top of the world again. The happiest day. Not just a happy day, the happiest day. The Jewish calendar, equal with Yom Kippur. Equal with Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur. Ah, davening, dancing away in Yom Kippur. Forgiveness for our sins. Closeness to God. Chamisha Ba'av is equal. Equal. Not going into the reasons why, that for another time. Very strange. Why put it now? You'd have thought, leave us with our sins. No! That's exactly the point. Yes, we have our times of less happiness. Times to mourn. But once that time is over, we can break out the wine and turn up the barbecue. It's gone. Everything will be ended. It's like the cycle of life. There are sad times, depressing times, but out of the ashes, I always say, I've got pictures. I went to Baba Yar in Ukraine and all these mass graves, and there was grass growing, coming out of the stone. And I thought to myself, that is a sign that life, plants, were growing on the gravestones. And everyone was upset. I was about that Rabbi Kiva who was crying when everyone was crying when they saw the fox running out of the temple. He was laughing away. He said, why is he laughing? Why are you crying? You're seeing a fox. He says, because it says the prophecy, the fox will run over the temple. He says, just like this prophecy has come true. So also everyone else was crying, oh, plants, all it's not respectful. I said, no. It's a sign of life, even in death. Even death, big destruction of all of it. There is life, there is plants, there is revival. And that's why we have the happiest day of the year, not a week away. Yes, it's morning. But once it's gone, be happy again. Rejoice. Morning will be ended soon, we hope. Speedily in our days, we will see Moshiach, and then we will really be able to appreciate what the temple was. And hopefully all the questions will be answered. Why, what, who, and where? With the coming of Moshiach, b'mehero b'mehero. Oh, before we finish, you had a question.
Disappeared in
good.
Going back to you were telling about it was absolutely wonderful over 5,000 years ago when we had the temple.
It was destroyed in the year 70, which, so 70, so that's 2,000, 1,000
years or whatever it is, yeah.
Less than 2,000.
70 was the third year of the riots of Merod Bar Kokhba.
No. That was a Babylonian first temple in year 70.
No, the second temple.
Yeah.
The second temple was destroyed. It was finished.
Yeah. Right. You were saying that everything was going well and it was wonderful. We didn't have any problems like anti-Semitism. People didn't have any problems.
Didn't say we didn't have any problems with anti-Semitism.
They were queuing up in the hundreds to see Moses.
Yeah, there was always wars, even in that time.
Wars, always the enemies.
But we usually won.
Comparing it to today, 5,000 years later, I mean, this is a modern, this is anti-Semitism. You had anti-Semitism then, which was your hostile neighbours. Mm. That was a different force of anti-Semitism. So why is it so wonderful? 5,700 years ago.
Well, 5,700 years ago would have been wonderful because the Earth would have just been created. So that would have been a wonderful time, I'm sure. Or they would have just been 70 years old. I'm sure. But anyway, taking your point seriously. Pardon?
Just the life of man.
Just the life of man. Yes. But taking your point seriously, yes, there were wars. You look into Nech, even the temple, there were wars. People came to fight, but because of the protection of the temple, we won those wars with very few casualties. And of course, look, the fact the temple was destroyed was the biggest case of anti-Semitism that there could be, obviously. Mm. So, you know, of course these things happened and they were there all the time.
there were also things from within the Jewish people, like they say that the Bet HaMikdash nechrav b'glal sinat chinam, because of needless hatred, and that came from within, not from without. There were enemies from without, but there was hatred also from within, which weakened us, I presume.
Can I just ask a question?
Yes, please do, Dolly.
On a completely separate subject, not as intelligent as yours.